way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the
Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Wednesday, May the 13th, 2026, and that usually would mean it is interview day. It is not interview day. It is expert counsel Q&A day because my guest, who is a gentleman named Philip Fry, who's going to talk to us about pigeons in a way that I bet you will be surprised about if you tune in tomorrow. Due to time zone differentials, because this is an international guest, could not do Wednesday and cannot do the normal time that I do interviews at noon. We will be interviewing him tomorrow live at either 9 a.m. tomorrow. And that will be a live stream. This, of course, is not a live stream because we can't do the show that I do for experts as a live stream. It would be very difficult. I'd have to have six or seven busy people standing by to wait one at a time to answer their questions. That just doesn't work. So we run at things a little bit differently for these Q&A shows. You guys send me your questions. I send them to the expert council members. They record them and send them back to me, and I mix it all together, create, I think, what is one of the most amazing variety show-type podcasts ever created. I really do. The sheer breadth of subject matter that we cover with this council is pretty amazing, and today will be no exception. So if you want live stream, tune in tomorrow for a rare Thursday live stream and a rare morning AM live stream at that. Today, what do we have, though, for you? I do not have Chris Rossini, Dr. Ron Pollard, and McAdams for you out of Liberty highlights. They just didn't have time to get it ready for me early. And I also did tell Chris, can you guys send me something other than Iran? I know it's a big story, but it's not the only story. I think we've beaten that horse to death, and they just didn't have anything they could fire off to me this week. So we'll see what they come up next week. So we're leading off today with Joel Riles, who's continuing his series on dog training. Today's segment is called Getting Obedience the First Time, Every Time with Your Dog. Again, that's Joel Riles. Jesse Markowitz will talk about using Start9 as a data storage device and remote access. Also, some of the services that are available and where you should start out with it. Start9 is an amazingly powerful tool. It really is. And Jesse is getting booked right now by Dorothy for a show just on Start9. But today you'll get a really good overview of some really important components of what Start9 can do for you. Matt Sersley will talk about influencers selling you the idea of a trust for tax savings. Are they selling you snake oil? We'll let Matt explain that to you. Do solar components age based on simple time, or is it time in use? And some advice for a person rebuilding a solar-powered system for a camper, along with a great list of recommended vetted tools, or actually components, including like chargers, power stations, charge controllers, batteries, that was included by Ryan in this one. Then Mike Melito, I told you we get diversity here, right? Mike Melito will give you thoughts on steel competition shooting and gearing up for it. And then let's throw a little real estate on this, huh? Antonio Gatto will talk about how do you go from great idea to execution with first-time rental property. And then I did a show this week on cooking. By the way, I want you guys out there to email me with the cheap foods that were like comfort foods you loved as a kid that your mom or grandma or grandpa or whatever used to make for you, especially those of you that grew up in the 60s, 70s, 80s time frame. Because there's a lot of stuff we've forgotten about. And I had a lot of fun with the segment of the show that I did on cooking this week, talking about stuff my grandma used to make. And so far, I've only gotten 2 emails about that subject. So send me your emails. And no matter how kooky, ooky, little kitty, or whatever it is, just send it. What is it that you remember? Like, when you went home and you were like, your mom's like, I'll make whatever you want tonight. And you were like, oh, make that thing. What was that thing? And not like lobster thermidor, right? Like the thing that is like people would forget about that was a common thing of the time. I think it would be a really fun show, or at least a segment on like a multi-topic show. But what I have for you today is something totally different. So I had an email come in today. And I think this is a great question. And this is a perfect example of you can know too much to be a good teacher. Okay? The question was basically, hey, I get brisket, like you say, when it goes on sale, and I grind it, but I end up with these kind of little steak pellets. It's kind of hard and chewy. It doesn't really bind together. Like, it's just not consistent, even when I twice grind it and go first course and then fine. And this guy's using a Cabela's Carnivore. I have a little bit of grinder envy, honestly. I asked him what grinder he's using. And immediately I thought I knew the answer, but then I sanity checked it against some things with using the crit method with AI, assigning it the persona of being an industry professional butcher that also helps at-home meat processors learn how to process their own meat. And it turned out my solution was completely right, but my reasoning was just a little bit off. And it turned out what you're supposed to do is what I do, and I never said to do it, because in my head, doing it since I was 14 years old, it would have been like telling you how to put your meat in a Ziploc bag and throw it in the freezer. But that is exactly the trap. When you're a very experienced person, especially if you didn't learn in a structured environment, you can assume people know things that they don't. So hopefully there'll be a couple lessons that come out of that one. With that, let's go ahead and drop on in and start listening to our experts today. Let's start off with, how do you get obedience from your dog the first time, every time, so you don't have to repeat yourself and go hoarse yelling at a daggone dog?
Hello, everyone. This is Joel with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy coming back at you again with another expert counsel segment. Today's question comes from Lisa. Lisa's had her dog now for a couple of months, and she's pretty confident that it understands what the commands mean, but it's just not doing them. She's starting to get frustrated. She said, "My dog knows what I'm asking, but it just doesn't listen." And here's the bottom line. In almost every one of these situations, the problem is not the dog. It comes down to three things. First, the handler is not communicating clearly. Dogs don't speak English. Every command has to be trained individually, and the dog has to understand what each command means before we expect them to obey it. If the dog doesn't fully understand what it means to sit or lay down, and they're not doing it, that's not disobedience, that's just confusion. The second problem is you're usually not having a big enough consequence for disobedience. We use a prong collar and give a pop when the dog is disobedient, but you want to make sure absolutely that your dog understands what the command means before you start doing that. If you give a command and the dog disobeys the command, and then there's no consequences, what you're actually teaching the dog is that it's okay to just ignore me. And the third problem is being inconsistent. And this is actually probably the biggest one most people struggle with. People use different words for their commands, or they mix them up sometimes, or they sometimes correct for misbehavior and other times they just let it go. What this does is it creates inconsistency in your dog's obedience. They think, well, sometimes I have to do this when he says, but sometimes not. And if they're distracted or there's something else they want to do, they'll think in their mind, well, maybe I can get away with it today. But once the dog gets clear communication and understands that there's going to be a consequence, and the handler starts applying these concepts consistently every time the dog does a behavior, suddenly everything will get better. I always recommend using the prong collar because it allows for very clear communication, and it's the hardest of the correction collars to mess up as a handler. The system is very straightforward. One direction, one correction. You're going to give a command one time, and if the dog obeys, you're going to praise them. Seats. Good seats. If it's just starting off in its obedience, I usually reach down and give it a little pet on the head, or if I have it up on a platform, I'll give it some love, but I don't want to get so excited that it breaks the position. I just want to let them know they're doing a good job. If the dog doesn't obey the command, I'm going to give a correction. I'm only saying the command once. Seats. If it doesn't seats, fooey it with a slight pop. Seats. Then, if it seats, I praise it. If it doesn't, I'm going to correct again with a slightly harder pop. So the cycle is command, obedience, praise. Command, disobedience, correction, repeat the command. If I'm having to give corrections and repeat the command, each time I give the correction, it's going to be just a little bit more than it was the last time. You're going to repeat this process until the dog obeys. And the moment they do, you're going to give them praise. If it was harder for the dog, you're going to give them a little bit more praise. Just be careful not to get so excited yourself that then the dog breaks the position. No anger, no frustration, just clear communication. Over time, what this does is it teaches the dog that the first command is the one that matters the most. When this is done correctly, You as the handler are going to be more calm and comfortable with your dog, and your dog is going to start obeying commands the first time without even needing to use the lead. Also, your dog is going to have a high level of confidence because even if they get the correction, once they obey, they know that you're happy with them, and then it reinforces in their mind, just do the command the first time it's given and my person will be happy with me. After a month or two of following this process, the dog should rarely need to be corrected. Sometimes they might be slightly distracted and I'll just give a light bump on the lead just to get their attention. And then they look at me and go, oh yeah, sorry boss. And then they'll follow the command. Make sure you're always consistently praising your dogs when they do what you want. Even if you're a little internally frustrated through this process, you have to understand this is just part of dog training. It's part of the process of getting where you want to be. And so just understand that going in so that you're not angry with the dog when it obeys, because dogs are very much in the moment. They're gonna, as soon as they do the command, if you're still mad at them, they're like, but I thought this is what they wanted. As soon as they do it, you have to let all the past go and be like, good job, buddy. Good seats. Give them a little rub on the head. That's what you need to do. Pretty quickly, you're going to be able to have obedience with your dog without even using the lead. This is actually how we teach people to build up to off-lead obedience. Once you hit a certain point in this training, it's just going to click for both you and your dog. The dog understands the rules, and you as a handler have built a habit of consistently applying praise and correction with your commands, and the dog just does them the first time. The dog is happy, and it knows exactly what you want. So I hope this was helpful for you. If you'd like more information learning how to train your own dog, check out Canine Academy by going to thesurvivalpodcast.com and clicking on the Canine Academy banner, and check out the courses that we have there available. And if you're looking for a working line puppy or a fully trained companion or protection dog, check out fortresscanine.com, click on the consult button, send us a message, and I'll reach out to you. Until next time, remember to train hard and stay safe.
Great stuff from Joel, and I find that, you know, when you really look at something, if you fully examine it, you should be able to drill it down to just three words to explain what to do. But if you really, really, really dig deep into something, you should be able to explain things with a single word. And when it comes to dog training and correcting poor behavior, that single word is consistency. That's what you'll notice across what Joel teaches over and over. There may be different applications, there may be different techniques employed, but the overriding thing that goes from one end to the other and back with everything Joel teaches with dog training is consistency. Doing things the same way every time relative to the system, which is basically, you know, it's the answer to a lot of things, but it's definitely the right answer to training dogs. Next up, we have a question about using Start 9 as a NAS device, or network attached storage device. And Jesse talks about how to do that and a lot of other cool things that it can do for you.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz from yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. Today I have a question from Michael. Michael asks, I need a NAS drive for our house. I'd love to do it with a Start 9 and not one of those other NAS brands for security purposes. Mainly, I want a safe place for cloud-style photo backups, password protection, possibly security cameras, and a media player would be an extra bonus. A quick walkthrough of how to set this up and what other hardware would be needed would be great. Great question, Michael. And honestly, this is close to home for me. Password management, Bitcoin, Lightning, and self-hosted storage for my notes and documents are exactly why I built my own Start 9 setup. Self-hosting photos and cameras are things I'm personally working toward right now. These are not theoretical use cases for me. Before we get into this, two quick notes. First, for those that don't know, NAS, N-A-S, stands for Network Attached Storage. It's a dedicated storage device for your home network to make files available to all your devices, phones, tablets, computers, whatever. It generally doesn't run much in terms of services. If you use a NAS, you'll still need other programs that are running on your various devices that will then store and retrieve data from the NAS. Start 9 has a server that runs a number of services and includes storage for those services to use. Second, Start 9 has recently released a new version of Start OS. It's now in public beta. If you're installing a new Start OS server, I recommend using the new version to take advantage of all the new features, especially the vastly improved networking. If you're running the older version right now, I suggest waiting to upgrade. The beta testing right now is primarily focused on cases relating to upgrading from that older version. Now, to Michael's question. Yes, you can do what you want with a Start9 server instead of a NAS. Actually, it might be even easier with StartOS because you actually want more than just a storage box. You're actually asking for a server running these key services for you. The basic steps are buy your server hardware, install StartOS, configure StartOS to be accessed locally, over Tor, or over a VPN, depending upon your needs. Then, install the first service you want, configure it, test it, and repeat for all the remaining services. The easiest service to start with, I think at least, is password management. It's a universally useful service and where I suggest everyone start. The service for StartOS is called Vault Warden. It's an open source, self-hosted, compatible version of the Bitwarden password manager. Vault Warden works with the Bitwarden browser plugins and phone apps. This gives you a great client experience in addition to the web client. Next, there are two services commonly used for photo backup. Image is purpose-built for photos and video. It looks and feels a lot like Google Photos, with automatic backup from your phone, facial recognition, albums, and search. It's what I'm personally experimenting with right now. The second option is Nextcloud. Nextcloud is a broader platform that handles photos along with file storage, calendars, contacts, and a lot more. That added scope comes with added complexity. Both are solid, widely used options. For media, StartOS supports the Jellyfin service. It's a free open source media server that can store your movies, TV shows, music, and stream them to devices in your house or outside it. Finally, security cameras. For this, you actually need the extra hardware, the actual cameras. These cameras need to be connected on your home network. Then you need a service to control and record from those cameras. The service that I have been investigating is called Frigate. It's, again, open source network video recorder. It has local AI object detection, so it can tell the difference between a person and a tree branch blowing in the wind. Frigate is not packaged for StartOS yet, but it's not a heavy lift to get there. I've packaged a couple services for StartOS myself, NTFY, Notify, and Garage, and Start9 liked both of them well enough to pull those into their official registry. Start9 has already stated that self-hosted cameras are part of the company direction, so I would not be surprised to see Frigate as an official registry option soon, and someone could always choose to package it up even sooner. For hardware, I suspect Michael's situation and the typical listener's situation are a bit different. For most people listening, the Start9 Server 1 handles everything we just talked about very well. Passwords, photos, some media, eventually cameras. If that covers what you need, the Server 1 is your answer. Get it, install your services, you're off and running. Michael, however, specifically asked about NAS storage. And here's the thing, when someone says NAS, they're usually thinking about really large amounts of storage, sometimes 10, sometimes even more terabytes of data. Often they're also looking to have something that has RAID. RAID is just a way of combining multiple physical drives, so the system sees them as one large, more reliable volume. If one drive fails, you don't lose everything. It's a common feature of dedicated NAS devices. StartOS currently supports only one data drive. That's an intentional design choice that keeps things simple and reliable, but it does mean that if you need more storage than a single drive can provide, or if you want RAID protection, the Server 1 alone is not the right fit. So what do you do if you need more? There are two paths. The first is special hardware that has a controller in it to combine the physical drives and present them to the operating system as a single large drive. StartOS then wouldn't know or care that there are multiple physical drives underneath. It just sees one big volume. The second is to use virtualization software like Proxmox. You run Proxmox on your custom hardware, then run StartOS as a virtual machine inside it. Proxmox handles the drive management and can take multiple drives and show them to StartOS as a single large drive. These approaches add flexibility, but do require more technical comfort to set up and maintain. Finally, make sure to protect your data with a backup. StartOS supports point-and-click backups. Use them. Do not skip this step. Now, if you know what you need, go forth and do it. If you'd like someone to work with you personally, step-by-step, you can hire me to help you figure out the right setup and get it up and running for your specific situation. Just reach out to me and we'll work it through together. We talked about a couple of interesting services already. There are many, many more additional services being added. If you are interested in being an alpha tester for new services, please let me know. In particular, I'm now working on packaging Vicunja Task Management and N8N Workflow Automation for StartOS, and I could really use some help with the testing. This has been Jesse Markowitz from YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. Keep these questions coming.
Great stuff, as always, from Jesse, and I'm really looking forward to it. It'll be sometime next month that I will have him on the air to go deeper into the entirety of what Start 9 can do for you as an individual. Next up, we're going to hear from Matt Sersley, who basically sent this to me unsolicited, and he said, I am tired of people selling trusts supposedly to save on taxes. So let's see what he has to say about that, because I think I know, and I think I damn well agree.
Hey, TSP, this is Matthew Sersley of AgrisTaxAdvice.com, here to talk about, frankly, something that really annoys me. I get a lot of emails and a lot of calls and a lot of people saying, hey, I hear that the rich people use trusts to save money on taxes. How does it work? I don't really know where this idea started. I think it kind of became a conflation of it can help save money by preventing your heirs from wasting the money. And so rich people can use it to keep the money in their family, but somehow people think it saves you money on taxes as well. Trusts are almost never a tax strategy. There are very rare cases where they can be, but they're primarily estate planning tools. And again, for the wealthy to protect their children from themselves from getting all the money when they're 18 or 19 or 20 and blowing it. So if your goal is to pay less in taxes, this is usually the wrong path to be going down. A lot of people think that trusts somehow hide income, or they change your tax bracket or lower your tax bracket. I see people advertise them as moving your money someplace untouchable. It maybe really is untouchable by the state court systems in some instances, but it's not untouchable by the IRS or the federal government. Some people say it avoids IRS scrutiny, and maybe it does, but I don't think anybody really knows if it does or doesn't. And the reality is the IRS knows exactly what a trust is. And even worse, trusts have their own tax rules, and almost always it's either going to be you pay the same tax or you pay more in tax. Essentially, you're not escaping the tax system. You're just choosing a very different and usually harsher version of the tax system. So first of all, there are two types of trusts. There are revocable. You can undo them. And there are irrevocable. Once you set them up, you can't undo them. Revocable trusts literally do nothing for federal taxes. I don't know of any states where they affect state taxes, but maybe they do. But for federal taxes, they do nothing, because as long as it's revocable, you and the trust are considered the same thing. The tax code ignores the trust, and every bit of it flows back on your own personal return. So while they're very good for avoiding probate, although probate isn't as bad in some states as people make it out to be, so make sure that's actually a goal. Trusts can be excellent for privacy. They're excellent for estate organization, making sure your kids or your grandkids are taken care of and don't blow all the money. They're not a great tax strategy. And so if somebody sold you a revocable trust as a tax strategy, either they don't understand the tax code, or maybe they're just hoping that you didn't. Now, irrevocable trusts, you can't just undo it. You have to set it up. You have to set who the beneficiaries are. And so already to do this, you've given up the money, and maybe you can be one of the beneficiaries, but overall, it's not your money anymore. It's got to follow the rules of the trust. They have the same levels of tax brackets as you do. So there is a 0% and a 10% and a 12% and a 22%, all the way up to 37%. Except you hit the top federal rate at $15,000 of income if the money stays in the trust. So if this trust is generating income and it's over $15,000, you are paying the highest federal tax rate there is. for individuals, especially married couples, you don't hit that until you're at like $450,000 or $500,000. So you didn't save any taxes by doing this. You increase them, or you kept them the same if you're somebody who makes so much money that you're already at the top tax bracket. Great. You didn't do any good. That's if the money stays in the trust. If the money comes out, the money is taxed to the recipient. This is one of the few areas where it can work very well. If you set up a trust and the money's going to your 25-year-old kid who makes way less money than you, this may actually lower the tax of this income. But there's a catch even here, because there's something called the kiddie tax. Any income, well, any unearned income that a minor child has is taxed at their parents' rate. So if you're using this money to give the money to your 16-year-old, there's no tax savings. You literally just paid a bunch of legal fees to recreate your own tax bracket, at least until they're old enough to get their own. Now, I see a lot of people say this can save you money on state taxes. And that's true. It can. Because you can live in New York and New York City and set up a trust in Tennessee or Texas, where there's no state income tax, and you can fight at least to have that trust be considered truly a Tennessee or other no income tax place and avoid those state income taxes. Now, the rules on if this is going to work depend vastly on the state you're in, because they're going to look at things that like where the trustees are. So if you're the trustee, if you're the person who is in charge of managing the trust, well, New York is probably still going to win that fight and you're going to owe New York tax on it. Some states, particularly the states you imagine, New York, California, Illinois, New Jersey, they fight this very aggressively. And so even if you win, you might lose. Here's the bigger thing. Fine, you reduce your state tax, but if you increase your federal tax, that's not a win. I've literally seen people set these trusts up going, wow, I'm going to save 8% state tax. Yeah, but now the income went from being taxed at 24% to 37%. Unless you just really love the federal government and hate your state, I don't think that's a very good deal. Even then, it's not a very good deal, frankly. So, trusts are great. I am in the process of setting up a trust myself to make sure that my family is taken care of, particularly my kids are taken care of, when I'm gone. Great for estate planning. Great for asset protection. Very useful for special needs planning. If you have a child who is developmentally delayed and will not be able to take care of themselves, trusts make a fantastic amount of sense. In limited situation, they can be great for business succession. I've seen a lot of law firms where someone wants to leave the law firm to their kid who's in law school, but they're not a lawyer yet. Well, the trust can hold on to it until the kid becomes a lawyer and can then legally own the law firm. Very occasionally, yes, you can save some state taxes on it, or you can use this as a way to get some money to your kids and avoid some taxation on it. But for 99% of Americans, probably more than that, after all the expenses of setting up the trust, you're probably still negative. So if your goal is to save taxes, stop just listening to YouTubers talking about what they like to sell people. You should be looking at things like entity structure, deductions. If you're a business, the R&D tax credits are great now. Do retirement planning. Do time strategies. And for high earners, whether you're W-2 or business, there are investments you can make. Things like oil and gas and solar power production. That can have tax savings where you save more money than you invest in limited circumstances. These real savings are in really the boring, pretty repeatable strategies for the most part, not some sort of exotic legal structure. And if anybody is saying a trust is going to you avoid taxes, they're either defrauding you or they're too stupid for you to work with them. So, trusts are tools. They're powerful tools. They're great tools. They're not a tax hack. And if you treat them like one, you almost always just cost yourself money instead of saving yourself some money. Now, if you'd like to talk to me more about saving money on taxes, I'd love for you to reach out to me at agoristtaxadvice.com/TSP. I offer a free toolkit of tax savings measures there, and you get a chance to schedule a free phone call with me out in the next week or two. Thank you.
I'm going to tell you where I think a lot of these myths around trusts and all sorts of legal structures come from. A bunch of retards that are on TikTok making videos about how rich they are when they're not, talking about all these concepts that they don't know anything about, that they're just taking out of various books and things and talking about complex issues like they're simple. And then people hear this, and if the presentation's done the right way, they assume the person saying it knows what they're talking about, and they generally do not. So thank you for that one, Matt. And I want to always encourage all my expert counsel folks, if you have something like this that you want to talk about, you do not have to wait for an audience member to send a question in. Go ahead and spin up the segment in the allotted time. It was a little long there, Matt, but it was a good one, so I let it go. And send it on over, and we will get it on the air for you. On that, though, if you do want to ask a question of the expert counsel, then what you need to do is email me, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com, with TSPC expert in the subject line. Tell me who you are and what your and who your question is for. My question is for, you know, Ryan Stever or Mike Melito or Nicole Sauce or whomever. My question is, then give me your question in a single sentence. You can do it, I promise. Then hit return a couple times and give me the details. That way everybody knows what you're asking. You'll get a great answer. I'm not confused. The expert panel member's not confused. You're not confused. Everybody's on the same page, and that leads to good results. Now, on that, let's go ahead and hear about basically rebuilding, or in this case, probably just building a new solar-powered system for a camper.
Hey, TSB community. This is Ryan Steva from thehomesteadconsultant.com. Today, I've got a question from Eric. Eric asks, do solar panels age naturally over time, or do they age based on usage over time? It's an interesting question, and he's got some more details, but I'm going to answer this part of the question up front. And the answer is kind of neither. So basically, solar panels degrade based on light introduced degradation, or LID. This is going to be UV specific, or largely for the panels. And so as UV hits the panels, they're going to degrade at about 0.5% of rated wattage to a full percent of rated wattage per year over their lifetime, but only for the time that they're in the sun. So if I were to get a brand new panel and stick it in my shop where it's not being exposed to extreme heat and not being exposed to much light at all, it's basically, as far as functionally, it's not going to degrade at all. All right, so here's some of the details that Eric sent me. He's got a 2003 Lancer truck camper, which that's pretty cool, but it's 23 years old, or the panel that's on it is a 100-watt panel, and it's been on it for 23 years. Now that Eric is adding some additional use, electrical use loads inside of the camper, like a Starlink and some other things, he's wondering about increasing his solar input capacity. And he's wondering how degraded his panel is, and what he says is, over the 23 years, the vehicle has largely been in a shop, so the solar panel may have had exposure for anywhere from 2 to 3 years, somewhere in that range, of actual use in sunlight. And what I would say is that basically means your panel is going to act like it's 2 to 3 years old. So he goes on to ask, should he replace the panel or add more panels or both? And my answer is very specifically to replace the panel. So don't add panels to the existing panel. The new panels you get, not only are they very affordable, but they're going to be more efficient, meaning that they're going to have the same amount of wattage for in a smaller space, or the same amount of space with more wattage. Additionally, you don't want to mix and match different types of panels, so I wouldn't bother trying to salvage the panel that you have, maybe use it for a different project. Also, Eric mentioned that he has a Charge Wizard controller for the system. That's actually going to be a 120-volt plug-in, so grid or shore, sometimes it's called, plug-in system to charge the battery. So that's not actually connected to the solar panels. The solar panel itself it's a 100-watt solar panel. It should have its own charge controller. In some cases, people use like 14-volt panels and hook them straight to lead-acid batteries. I would definitely not recommend this, but it does work and people do it sometimes. And so there may not be a charge controller, but likely there's a separate charge controller that you're going to need to look for and find and verify what that controller is and if it can handle the new panels you want to put on. Generally speaking, charge controllers, panels, and batteries have come a long way, both in what they can do as well as what their cost is in the last 23 years. So I would actually consider replacing the entire system, because if you've got a 23-year-old charge controller, it may work fine, but a newer MPPT charge controller is going to work a lot better. You're likely dealing with an old PWM charge controller. With that said, I would also recommend upgrading your battery. So you didn't say in your email whether or not you're using the battery from the vehicle. If you are, I would highly recommend not using the vehicle's battery, because you could drain the battery to the vehicle and not be able to start it. So I would recommend a separate battery if that's not already what you have set up. I would also highly recommend a LiFePO4 or lithium iron phosphate battery. Many of them that you can get now have a battery management system or a BMS that's built into them that essentially allows them to be a drop-in replacement for your old lead-acid batteries, including your deep-cycle lead-acid batteries, but you can actually cycle them much lower than a lead-acid battery. They have way more capacity for the weight, which is excellent, and they generally have a much longer shelf life. The other thing to consider here is getting a pre-built solar generator. With some of the value brand generator solar generators, or I should say mobile power stations, they have become so affordable that it actually makes sense to go with those instead of trying to build out your own system. So the benefit there is you have a mobile system, so you can take it with you if you need it for a campsite or another excursion somewhere else, or for backup at your house. And it's already got the charge controller, the inverter, and everything else built into it. All right, now the last recommendation I'm going to give you here, or thought on how you could improve your system, is instead of using solar panels, to use an alternator charger. So you could use that in combination with a solar array and setup. However, in my opinion, if I had a camper that had solar panels on top of it, I would probably never use the solar panels, because I want to put my camper in the shade anytime I can. Now, when I'm driving, I'm going to be in the sun, but at the same time, if I'm driving, my alternator is going to be going. And one of these alternator chargers is going to be able to charge your system between 600 watts and 800 watts, depending on the one you get. It's going to be able to determine if your vehicle is running or turned off, so it won't drain your vehicle's battery. It will only charge when the alternator is actually running. And I'm not a huge fan of solar panels on top of campers or vehicles, because one, they could fly off if they're not properly secured, and then you are liable for damage or injury that would occur from them. Two, they're going to reduce your fuel economy because of the way that they create drag on the roof. And like I already said, typically you don't want to park in the sun. So I would actually highly recommend installing an alternator charger system. I'm sending some links to Jack to add to the show notes. These are going to be items that I've previously worked with and vetted and like. So if you need either examples for what I'm talking about, or you want some products to pick up that will work in these situations, go ahead and look at those links in the description. If people want to get a hold of me, you can find my information at thehomesteadconsultant.com, or you can find a bunch of useful DIY informative videos on my YouTube channel just by searching The Homestead Consultant. And of course, until next time, go get your hands dirty.
So just my only follow-up with that is to make sure that you realize you can get links to all the stuff that Ryan recommends that he's personally worked with and has vetted. If you go to today's episode, again, it's 3845. If you happen to be listening sometime in the future and need to go use the search feature on the site, if you just type in EP in the search feature at survivalpodcast.com, just type in EPI-3845, and it'll pull this episode up right away for you. And I have links. It'll be right under Ryan's bullet point, components Ryan recommended, and there's five of them with links straight to Amazon. So even if you're not going to buy them, if you want to see exactly what he's talking about, and source them in some other way or what have you, or if you're just interested, they're all there for you. Next up, let's hear from Mike Melito about shooting steel and gearing up for steel shooting competitions.
Hey, TSP. Michael here to answer your gun and gum-related questions. Got a question from David about entering competition shooting. More specifically, steel matches with a handgun. He says, I recently participated in a steel shoot after a friend's invitation and have decided to do more. I want suggestions on gear, guns, and or optics. I have a stock Glock 19 that I carry regularly, and that's what I used, but more gear is never bad, right? And he continues on with three different options. I'm going to interject here. Talk a bit about steel matches and steel challenge. I have shot many different kinds of handgun competitions, IDPA, USPSA, and steel matches, both outlaw and steel challenge, and I've been blessed to win more than a few. I just say that to establish some bona fides. Now, steel challenge is like drag racing with a handgun. You will stand in a box, your hands above your head, the buzzer will go off. You will skin that smoke wagon and go to town as fast as possible. You hit all the steel targets, make your best attempt before timing out, and then shoot the stop plate. Fastest to get all hits wins. The hits part's pretty important. And other steel challenge matches vary to like man-on-man steel challenges where both opponents will stand mano-a-mano, buzzer goes off, and the first one to shoot all their targets in the stop plate wins, and the other one is eliminated. Just as like a brief overview of steel matches. Now, I love shooting competition, and I love shooting steel competitions with a handgun. It's one of my favorites. That said, you should look at what you want to get out of competition. Are you in it to win it? Or are you in it to get the best that you can get with your carry gun, if you are not willing to change your carry gun? Now, all you Glock fanboys, take a deep breath or maybe skip forward a couple 30-second fast-forwards in this. I get issued my first duty carry Glock around 18 years ago. I have shot many competitions with a Glock. I've won competitions with a Glock. I currently work as a private security contractor helping out different government agencies. Sometimes I still have to carry a Glock. I can shoot a Glock. I don't like Glock. The fact that you're asking about a bunch of different options leads me to believe that you realize that Glock is not the best either. And the fact that USPSA and Steel Challenge has different divisions so that Glocks don't have to compete head-to-head with 1911s or 2011s tells you that everybody knows that Glocks really can't go toe-to-toe with those. So you really got to think about that. And if you really are going to continue to carry a Glock 19 and you want to be the best with it, then just compete with what you have. If it is a sanctioned match, then shoot in production division. I shot in production division for a long time. And all that basically means is it's a production out-of-the-box gun. If you want a better gun, oh, stepping back, his three options. One is upgrade his current carry gun. Well, here's the thing. If you start upgrading the Glock, at what point is it still a Glock anymore? You get different sights, you get different triggers, you start Dremeling stuff. Is it really even a Glock anymore? And a lot of those custom upgrades you're going to do to the trigger, I would not recommend for carry, both for reliability and liability. So if you're going to just stick with a Glock, I would just maybe change the sights out and stick with it. Option one. Option two, a new handgun. He says budget of $1,000. I hope that you will heed some sage advice here. Even if you do plan on getting a better gun, just shoot with what you have for a while. And when you're at competitions, generally people there are very nice and friendly, and they'll have a lot of really nice kit, different guns, very common ones that will be shot in competition. Ask at the end of a stage if you can, ask the range master that it's okay, but ask if you can shoot a couple of rounds through different guns. This will tell you what you like, what you can reach in magazine release without changing the grip on your hand, what has a good natural point of aim, right? And this will prevent you from dropping, let's say, $1,350 on a gun that doesn't really work for you. that's a very specific number because I know because I've done it. So just shoot with what you have for a couple of competitions and try other loadouts to see what you actually like. SIGs, CZ Shadows, 1911s, 2011s, optics, no optic. No, optics are faster, and single actions are faster. That's why there's different divisions, right? They don't compete head-to-head. Unless, going back to if it's an outlaw match just means they don't abide by sanctioned USPSA or Steel Challenge rules. They make up their own rules, in which case you'd have to look up the divisions. But try a couple of different guns. Try a CZ Shadow 2. They're real common on the competition circuit. Try a 2011. Like an actual 2011, not some cheap Turkish clone. You know, try an M17, or if you want to shoot a race Glock, somebody there will likely have a Glock 34 or a Glock 17L. Because there's really no point to run a Glock 19 again unless you want to be good with your carry gun. It's a compact gun. It's meant to be a compact gun, and a compact gun is not going to go toe-to-toe with a full-size fighting handgun. So try somebody's, again, Glock 34. They've been a mainstay in, like, production division for a long time. If you are going to go the Glock route, I recommend going with an older Gen 3 because they have the most aftermarket support. Because the patent's expired, so there's a plethora of aftermarket stuff for them, which is the arena you're going to dive into if you want to make a Glock decent for competition. Now, your third option is like a blue sky budget, and believe me, you can spend a lot of money. Like a Staccato XL is, what, $4,500 out of the box, and you're probably going to do stuff to it. Probably put a pretty expensive optic on it. If you are going to go super expensive, that's probably what I would recommend. I'm blessed to have a couple of old, I say STI, they were STI before they were Staccato, but I have a couple of STI full-size, they're fantastic guns. Yeah, they're worth the money, they're expensive. If you want a blue sky budget, get an actual Staccato 2011, or even higher, right, like an Atlas, and you could easily drop, you know, $5,000 on your setup, if you want to go that route. These are the Ferraris of the handgun world. Like a lot of European import sports cars, they're going to require more maintenance. You better know how to tune them and, you know, run them on premium, but they're absolutely faster. Hope this was helpful. And I just want to conclude by applauding you for getting into competition shooting. It's a great way to build skill, shoot under stress and time pressure, and, you know, competition shooting is a great American pastime. With that, thanks, guys. Thanks, David, for the question. Thanks, Jack, and have a blessed day.
Great stuff from Mike, as always. And the only thing I'm going to add to this is, I was going to say, I think shooting steel is a lot of fun. I don't care if it's a competition. I don't care if you're all geared up. I just think, bing, I just think it's fun. I think it's one of the more enjoyable target types to shoot at. It combines the consistency of, it stays there, you don't have to go put it back, of a paper target, with the convenience of like a self-healing target, with the fun component of a reactive target all in one. You shoot paper, it's a great diagnostic tool, but you really don't get any feedback unless you're like so close you can just easily see the holes, right? But you even that, you don't get any sort of auditory or visual real impactful feedback with that steel. You get that ping, and it just is a lot of fun, and I encourage you to find a way to add it to your training one way or another, whether through competition or just getting some of your own targets and ringing some steel. With that, listen, like I said, you want diversity, tune into an expert panel show at the Survival Podcast. We have covered dogs today. We have covered technology with Start 9, privacy tech. We have covered tax advice and not getting tricked by snake oil salesmen. We have talked about building solar-powered systems. And we have talked about steel shooting competitions and gearing up for that. And now we're going to talk about real estate with Anthony Gatto. And this is another place that, you know, you have to listen to people that have actually done it. All right? One of my laws of life, never take advice from anybody on anything that they have not proven to be highly competent at. right? It's not arrogance to say that. It doesn't mean that maybe they, you know a lot about the thing, too, and they don't know everything you know, but you don't know everything. That's all fine. But they better have actually done it. There are tons of people on TikTok and Instagram and all this other shit, you know, pretending to be billionaires or whatever, and they're talking to you about how rich you can get using the HUD program or some shit. Let me tell you something. The person that's actually independently wealthy from real estate is probably not on TikTok talking to you about it. They're out building their next property that they can rent or flip. They're out hunting for the next property. That's Anthony Gatto. Or, I'm sorry, Antonio Gatto. That's what he does. And he's here to answer your questions on real estate and, like, home improvement, handyman stuff, things like that as well. So if you have questions for him, you know how to get them to me. But this was a great question. It's basically, how do I go from idea to execution? How do I actually do this? So you got a person in the audience, they're like, I see the beauty of real estate investing. I get it. I want to do it. I want to take the approach of becoming a landlord and having a rental property. I want that to be my first step. I know sort of the things. How do I actually go from idea to execution here? Antonio's got a great answer for us.
Hello, TSP community. This is Antonio Gatto coming to you again from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where I'm always happy to answer all of your questions pertaining to home improvements and real estate. And this week's question comes in from Brandon. Brandon writes in, hello, Antonio. I am a first-time rental property buyer, and what suggestions do you have for what type, where, or where not to buy properties? I'm looking to buy my first rental property, and I wanted to know a few things I should watch out for and any suggestions for an easy-to-manage first property. I'm also open to commercial rentals as well. Thank you for your time, Brandon. Brandon, thank you very much for the question, and I'm more than happy to offer you some guidance today on helping you pursue that. I think it's very important first that we talk about the things that you should not do, and then later in the segment I'll tell you, we'll transition into steps that you can take to help this help you acquire this property smoothly. So right out of the gate, let's be very clear. I never suggest you or anybody getting started in real estate do any out-of-state landlording. You will be completely dependent on property managers, maintenance crews, repairmen, contractors, etc., and you're not even nearby to manage it and to see exactly what's going on. There is a big idea floating around in the real estate world that you can acquire one, two, or three properties near up-and-coming cities where some gentrification is taking place. I never suggest anybody do that. It's stressful, and it can really drag out, and especially for somebody new that is in your shoes, I highly suggest that you avoid that. And secondly, you definitely want to avoid any complete guts. Now, the reason for this is pretty simple. I think if you are looking to get into rentals and you buy a complete gutted property to start, you are going to quickly discover that it is going to take so much more time, so much more effort, and so much more money and stress that you originally allotted for. I want this to be a smooth transition for you. I would rather you spend a little bit more money on a house that needs less work than less money on a house that needs a lot of work. Now, as far as what type of house to buy, first off, make sure that it's in a safe area with low crime, preferably in a very good school district as well, too. Now, the reason for this is pretty obvious. If you have a family that is looking to rent and they have a couple kids, it makes it much more enticing for them to live in a school district that has really high ratings, etc. And in addition to that, if you ever decide that you want to unload that property and sell it, homes that are in good school districts, generally speaking, sell a lot faster as well, too. Now, let's talk about distance from where you live. You definitely want it to be within a reasonable distance from where your house is. And the reason for this is pretty obvious. If you are going to be managing it, you're going to be doing the maintenance, you're going to be doing the repairs. What I personally do is I don't buy anything that's more than 10 miles from my personal residence. And the reason for that is pretty obvious. If I get a call that water heater went out, the furnace is out, there's a plumbing leak, I want to be able to get to it pretty quickly because I'm the one that's actually doing the work. If you get into a property that's 20, 30, 40 miles away, that can be a bit hassle. And chances are that can be a hassle. And chances are you're going to be dependent on other contractors and repairmen. And I personally like to manage everything myself. So as far as the type of house for you to get, I would highly suggest a smaller to medium-sized home, preferably with a driveway and a garage. Now, the reason for this is smaller to medium-sized homes, they're generally cheaper to remodel and cheaper to maintain. And if you have one with a driveway and a garage, again, if you should ever sell someday, potentially 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, maybe you decide landlording is not for you. Homes with driveways and garages, generally speaking, sell a lot faster than any property with on-street parking. And they usually have a larger yard to go along with it. Now, you also want to look to make sure that if you're on the outside of city limits, if you are near public transportation, that is certainly a plus. You want to be near parks, lakes, restaurants, nightlife. If you have the option to get one near all of those amenities, I would highly suggest that you take it because, again, these are all much more enticing reasons that potential tenants would want to live there. And also, if you go to sell it someday, too, that particular house would sell a lot faster than the alternative when there's none of that available to potential buyers as well, too. So now, as far as the structure of the house goes, I would definitely like to see you buy a house with good bones and good mechanics if possible. Now, when I say mechanics, I'm referring to the obvious, your plumbing, your HVAC, your electric, etc. I would like to see you, if you're going to do some rehab work before you rent it out, stick with mostly cosmetic work if you can. If it needs a roof and some windows, I don't really have much of a problem with that. Those are very simple processes. If you need paint, flooring, siding, some landscaping, etc., basic maintenance like that and some upkeep, that's generally a lot cheaper. It goes a lot faster and there's not much complications as if you were going to do a complete total rewire or repiping of a house. And again, I'd rather you spend a little bit more for less work on your first property, just so that it's easier for you. You can get it done faster and you can get a tenant in there and it would be much easier for you to maintain as well too. Now, while you're looking for a property, it's very important that you ask yourself, would you live there and how easy would it be to sell? Put yourself in another person's shoes. If you just moved to your town out of state and you were looking for a place to stay, is it appealing? Does it have curb appeal? Is it near all the amenities that I mentioned before? And how easy would it be to sell? Is the house in a good location? Just remember the saying. There's a saying that goes out there, cheap crap is still crap. Again, I would rather see you spend more money and not have the problems moving forward, such as potentially reselling or finding it hard to rent. Now, there is also a saying in business that I'm sure many of you heard, and that is know your customer, KYC. Well, in real estate, we have another saying, and that is KYN, know your neighbors. So what I'm getting at with this, when you are looking for a potential property, do not be afraid to knock on the neighboring doors and introduce yourself. Don't be afraid to knock on the door and say, hi, my name's Brandon. I was just curious what your thoughts are in the neighborhood. I was thinking about buying this house. Do you like living here? Is there anything that you don't like about living here? That is a very good tip. I always do that whenever I purchase a property. And while you are doing this, you are simultaneously screening your neighbors to know what type of person they are. Are they upstanding citizens? They may be able to let you in on some news of the neighborhood that the potential realtor doesn't know anything about. So I always suggest people do that. Don't be afraid to, again, knock on those doors and, you know, it makes a good impression on yourself as well, too. Now, as far as cost and money goes for you, I don't know your financial situation, but when it comes to rental property, I always suggest to pay cash if you can. But if you can't, I completely understand in 2026, the real estate prices, they are at all-time highs. I know that may not be feasible for most people, but if you can, great. If you cannot, I completely understand that. But with rental property, I hope that you would be able to have at least 50% down just so that you don't have that much of a backlog in cost moving forward. And the other reason that I'm very big on paying cash for rental properties is because if you don't and you have a mortgage on that, remember, you are dependent on the tenant paying the mortgage and the additional rent that you have to. And that's why I like to pay cash for it, because if there is a worst case scenario to where I would have a tenant that does not pay rent or there's a problem, I'm not responsible for making the mortgage payment. It just becomes an inconvenience at that point that you have to evict them, and you're not, in addition to that, worrying on paying the rent as well, too. So finally, I do want to suggest to you, highly suggest that you listen to my segment that I did back on February the 5th when Jack aired it on the expert council, and that is the proper screening of tenants. Make sure that you listen to every step and that you follow that. I do not want to see you get bad tenants for your first group of people that you get in there. And if you follow those steps, it has a very, very good track record of being accurate and being prudent for you moving forward. So best of luck in your search, Brandon. If I can help you with anything else, feel free to reach out to me anytime and keep those questions coming into Jack. And as always, have a great rest of the day and never stop learning. And we will see you on the next episode.
Fantastic stuff from Antonio. Real estate has been, and I believe for a long time to come, will be one of the greatest ways to build wealth that there is. There's also a lot of risk in it if you don't mitigate your risk properly. So it's good to learn from people who have actually done so. And we will be talking to Antonio much deeper on this and other topics very soon. Recently, I hit up the expert council. Like, if you haven't been on the show soon, put in a guest app. Well, pretty much all of them have, or most of them have, and Antonio has. So Dorothy's working to get him booked and on the air with you guys soon. Because this is, I don't think that real estate's something everybody should do. But I think it's something that everybody should be aware of so you can decide if it's something that's right for you. Anyway, now we get to have an answer to my Now I'm going to answer my question for today's show and wrap things up. And hell, after that tripping on my own tongue, I better read the question verbatim for you here. This was from Trent. He said, "Hi, I recently made my own ground beef from brisket for the first time, but I couldn't get the texture to turn out right. It felt like mini steak pellets, even when I reground it a second time. I started with meat just around the freezing temperature, did a coarse grind, then fine, and was wondering if I could get some advice on improving texture. Thanks, Trent." All right, so I want to start out with one thing. I've always said to get your meat really nice and cold, to keep it nice and cold, and being like a little bit frozen is the way to go. I don't think this is a problem for Trent, but I want to make sure, since I've realized what I'm leaving out here, that does not mean actually frozen. It should not be a meat sickle. It should have just a little bit of kind of outside coated freezing, but if you push, the meat should still give, because you can actually create a situation, if it's really frozen, where some of the meat's actually exactly what you don't want, mushy and also too tough. So just, I wanted to say that. And definitely when you go to a second grind, do not like refreeze the coarse grind, just run it right back through. But that's really not Trent's issue here. So maybe I should actually tell you how I handle meat when I grind it, specifically beef. So when I grind beef, assuming it's just for ground, I'm going to put it away because we're going to take it out and, you know, make anything from tacos out of it to hamburger to anything else you would do with ground beef. I almost never grind less than about 12 pounds. It's kind of like a, like if it's not that much, I'll you know, take the trim or whatever and freeze it and I'll grind it later. So I usually get up into where it's worth cleaning the grinder and any other equipment that I use. I will then grind the beef, and a lot of times I honestly stick with a coarse grind, and I don't even twice grind, and I don't have this problem, which would seem counterintuitive. But even if I'm going to twice grind, whether I twice grind with a coarse or I twice grind go coarse to fine, when I'm done doing that, I mix the meat. And I have one other step that I put in here, and that is I add some salt. And salt actually will help with this as well. I generally add about a half a teaspoon per pound of meat, okay, is about how much I use. And you can use a little more or a little less. But to me, and this is one of those things, like when I sanity checked this with AI, I'm doing the right thing, but I didn't really know what it did. I've been doing this since I'm 14. When you mix it, then you have to mix it enough to distribute the salt through the meat. And the other thing you're doing when you mix it is you want to make sure you distribute your fat through the meat. So generally speaking, we're looking for an 80-20 to an 85-15. Anything in that range. Do not believe the hype and bullshit. You got to get exactly 80-20 to get the perfect burger. No, bullshit. Yeah, 78. you know, 22, yeah, get it close. But you don't want to drop down like a 70-30. It's too much fat. And if you do a whole brisket without trimming, you're probably at least there, if not worse. And so now you have too much fat, right? But even if you get your fat ratios right, and even if you're kind of, and I like to do this, I kind of like, here's the fat, here's the red, there's some fat on the red, but, you know, like, this is your main fat, your main red. And, like, every so often, you're pushing fat through with the red, so you're kind of distributing it better. You still don't have enough distribution of the fat through the meat. You're still going to have areas like, you know, this pound, if you just started grabbing clumps out and packing away pounds, this pound of meat is, you know, well mixed, and this pound of meat has a lot of fat in it, and this pound of meat has a little bit of fat in it. That's how it's going to be. So we need to mix it. Now, when you mix ground beef that you're going to use as ground beef, not sausage, you don't want to accidentally turn it into sausage. With some exceptions of certain sausages where you want a chunky consistency, generally speaking, when we make sausage, we want to emulsify it. We bring enough fat and protein out and combine back together into an emulsion to create that kind of snap, that kind of sticky nature, that kind of uniform texture that sausage has that good burgers or meatballs don't. Okay? So you can absolutely overmix it if you're not careful. But you want to mix it till it starts to get a little bit tacky. Okay? And you are creating a little bit of an emulsion here, but it's more about bringing certain components out of the proteins and causing them to bind to each other and to the fat. So it's kind of like an emulsion, but it's not all the way to an emulsion. You certainly don't want it to be a full emulsion like a sausage might be. And even that has variations. Like if you're making like a kielbasa type sausage, it's pretty emulsified, but it's nowhere near emulsified the way a hot dog is, right? So there's variances even in there. But you what, and you will feel this happen if you use your hands. As you mix that meat, you will feel it happen in that it will just almost like there'll be this point where you just kind of, oh, there it is. And you will only really get there with practice. By doing it, you will gain experience and you will gain this intuition of that's good. And don't worry if you go a little bit too little, it'll be better than it is, right? And if you go a little bit too long, it'll be maybe a little over emulsified, but it'll be okay. But when you get it to where it just starts to stick to your fingers, then you've done that. And when you add the salt, I do that mainly because if I'm going to like pre-press burgers, so I have a burger press I just bought, but even before that we would use a little hand press. And if I'm going to pre-press and make, let's say, a dozen burgers, put them in a vacuum seal bag, throw them in the freezer so we can pull them out and cook them one at a time on a flat top, it's a frozen patty. And the best way to cook a frozen burger patty is while it's still frozen. Trust me on this. I won't get into it today. It's too much to add. So that frozen patty goes straight down on the griddle, and it cooks as it defrosts, and you flip, and you get this beautiful char. However, you can salt the outside. You will never have another chance to get salt on the inside that way. So I like, that's why I've always done it. It puts some flavor inside the meat, so no matter what I do with it, there's salt inside the meat. All right. But at the same time, all those little salt crystals when you're mixing the meat, They're rough, and they actually are kind of cutting into the protein a little bit and letting a little bit of the particles within the protein kind of come out and bind together. So this is the simple answer. When you're done grinding, add some salt to your meat to taste and mix it till it gets a little bit tacky, and your problem will go away. Now let's go a different level here. Traditionally, butchers never grab a single cut, throw it in a grinder. Ground beef has been affordable because it's always been after you make everything pretty and cut your primals down into steaks and roasts and everything. All the stuff you trimmed off, that's your ground meat. And expert butchers kind of like classify that meat into this is really lean, this is tough working muscle, this is really fatty, this is the premier ground beef, and that would be chuck. So brisket goes into the hard-working muscle with plenty of fat, but it's still a hard-working muscle. And it often will benefit if you find, let's say, a brisket on sale, and you buy like a whole packer brisket. As I said earlier this week, you probably still need to take some fat off it, even if you do the next step. Again, you're shooting for kind of that 80-20 to 85-15 range in your fat content. Okay, but then if you were to take trimmings from like a top sirloin butt, or a bottom round or a top round or an eye of round and add maybe to the total weight. Let's say you had 10 pounds of brisket. If you add 2 to 3 pounds of these other cuts, you're putting a different type of muscle grain in the protein in, and you're creating a more uniform overall product. So brisket, I love grinding brisket. It's super affordable, especially when it goes on sale. It makes an incredibly delicious burger. It really does. But it's one of the less forgiving meats. So if you can find chuck on sale, right? And this idea that you can't freeze meat, take it out, grind it, and then refreeze it is bullshit, okay? I don't think you should be like freezing your meat 15 times before you use it. But that one-time process is fine. Don't let it prevent you from making a better product. So if you happen to find a brisket on sale and you're not ready to grind right now, chuck it in the freezer. Right? Chuck it in the freezer. Or part it out and chuck the part you want to grind in the freezer if you're going to do that. And then look for a sale on like chuck. And then make your combination. But I don't care what you grind, especially with beef, always mix your meat. And this is something we always did. And that's why I never told you to do it, because to me, I don't know, I just thought that anybody would like look at the meat and go, that's not exactly, like, I need to make it uniform. And by making it uniform, you always get to the point where you make it a little tacky. And once you make it a little tacky, you lose kind of that pelletized texture. If you try to put it into a patty, you get a much more consistent, locked-together patty. So why does the meat you buy at the grocery store seem to always have that stickiness to it? And sometimes it is actually mixed, but it's because they use much larger machines that work a lot harder, that apply a lot more friction, and they have been optimized over time to spit out a product that's pretty much ready to go when they spit it out. And then again, the other thing I've told you, when you buy those big chubs of meat that you think, oh, cheap junk meat, and then you buy the stuff in the cellophane with the foam bottom that looks all beautiful, maybe they hit it with a little bit to brighten it up, a little additive there to make the red show out more that they don't have to disclose as an ingredient, right? But most of that stuff in grocery stores today, all they did was take the 80-20 chub and run it back through their grinder a second time. Well, that's another mix. When we grind, we mix. So that's part of why that always seems to come out the way you would expect it to. Anyway, with that, we've wrapped things up. Again, remember, even though this is a Wednesday and we did an expert panel show, it does not mean the week is over. We're going to be talking pigeons. Instead of talking chicken, we're going to be talking pigeons tomorrow with Philip Fry. And I think you will enjoy the show if you tune into it. I thank you for tuning into today's show a great deal. And I appreciate all of you. And I will catch you tomorrow with that interview with Philip.
They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. You don't have to live the way they tell you to. Revolution.